Coronavirus is in many ways an ecological crisis. It is a shock to the global system, a sign that we're living in unsustainable ways and bringing acute pressure to bear on the life systems of planet Earth. And in this difficult moment, as we struggle to find our way out of the crisis, the pressures on our atmosphere are only growing greater and greater. Climate change is happening, and it's happening now. So today we ask, what is to be done? And are there signs that the world is finally embracing the radical politics of environmental realism?
We're the number one energy producer in the world. Soon it will be by far the number one. It's tremendous wealth, and I'm not going to lose that wealth. I'm not going to lose it on dreams, on windmills.
How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words.
We have no time to waste.
We are building a movement that says we will stand in solidarity with the people of the Global South.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. The pandemic is far from over, and our escalating climate crisis is sadly not going away either. This year, the UK will host COP26 in Glasgow, the annual United Nations meeting that reviews the state of global action on climate change. Boris Johnson is keen to tout his climate credentials, but does his case add up? And can we use the summit coming to the UK as a massive springboard to climate activism? Sian Berry joins us to address these questions and more. Sian is co-leader of the Green Party of England and Wales since 2018 and a member of the London Assembly. We'll be asking for her critical appraisal of where the world is on climate change and what our blueprint for campaigning over the next 12 months should be. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. Hope you enjoy it.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria, and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then. But that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
We're recording this on the day after Biden's inauguration, but it won't be going out till the weekend. One of the executive orders is that he's rejoined the Paris Accord, the global climate deal. I don't know if you all saw the amusing Ted Cruz response, which is this means he cares more about the citizens of Paris than the citizens of Pittsburgh, which I think slightly misses the point. But I feel pretty damn positive about this. What are your thoughts on the election? And do you think that the environment is going to play a kind of major part in the debate going forward? And environmental politics is the kind of real politics.
Yeah, and I think it's incredibly positive that he put that on his list of things to do. Plus, of course, cancelling the Keystone XL Canada-America pipeline, the oil pipeline that's been so controversial that Trump revived. I think those two things signal a real shift in climate policy and seriousness. And I think that's really important globally. If America becomes serious again, that leaves out the excuse that other countries have of going wrong. Like, I think Trudeau was hiding behind, he's always supported the pipeline. And I think he was slightly hiding behind Trump, where Trump was getting all the flak for it. But then suddenly it's cancelled by Biden. He's completely isolated and he's sort of having to swing behind. That's the sort of influence America ought to have, influence for good around the world. And that's just such a good sign. It's really nice.
I mean, my worry with American environmentalism is that just because of the way that the kind of land rights and fracking rights and oil rights work. You know, in the UK, they're owned by the Crown, and so it's possible to have a kind of state-determining effect on energy use. But in America, you own the energy under your own land, and so you've got this kind of very disparate kind of sectional interest, which is quite difficult to guide from even at a state level, let alone at a federal level. But do you get the sense that just with the right person holding the reins that they can make the transformation that they need to make over the next 10 years?
It takes a lot of effort. I think that point about land rights is a really good one, because that's all about the local, the attention to detail, all the other sort of aspects of democracy that you need, the transparency, the ability to find out who's going and buying up the land, the rights to the minerals in your area, and be able to go and challenge them and campaign against them. All of those freedom of information rules, all of those rules on transparency and accountability, they all come into play. You need all of that in place. You can't just have one figurehead directing everything. I think that's very green of me to say that sort of thing, but I think it is really important that democracy and accountability goes right through the system, and that you're able to challenge at the right level. But setting the big targets at a national level, like we're going to be talking about at COP this year, those are really important too. You've got to have a target, you've got to have someone setting the direction of travel too.
Yeah, it's really exciting, isn't it? And Trudeau's Keystone Pipeline policy is one of the most embarrassing elements of this supposed shining light in North American progressive politics for the last 4 years. But he basically jumped into bed with Donald Trump on it. And the American argument was a little bit, you know, mercantilist as well, a little bit national interest, because a lot of the Democrats in Congress didn't argue against it on environmental grounds, but argued that, well, really, Canada's the only one that's going to benefit from this, and this is why Canada's really into it. And then Trump comes in and Trump says yes to the pipeline because anything to do with oil is good. And I think in terms of the discourse globally, I mean, having Trump gone, whatever Biden does is just a huge boost to the climate movement, because to have the most powerful person in the world, or at least at one time thought of as the most powerful person in the world, continually poo-pooing the idea of like climate change, and at best saying, well, it's going to affect the rest of the world, we're going to make sure it doesn't affect America and America's going to stay wealthy, it's just so destructive. I think it's just such a huge relief for everyone that he's actually gone finally after the chaotic few weeks.
Thinking more broadly, you know, there's been a sense, certainly over the course of the pandemic, that it might be good helping us meet the targets globally that we have to meet. But where is the world on climate change? Where are we compared to the minimum of where we need to be?
We're nowhere near yet. I mean, that is the problem at the moment. Even if we made all the Paris Agreement targets, that's aiming for 2 degrees. It's saying, oh, maybe we can get to 1.5 if we try hard enough. But the actual commitments made so far by the countries, we're talking about 3 to 4 degrees of warming. And that is still in the disaster territory. That's runaway climate chaos. So there's an awful lot still to do. We're not there yet.
And one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is that, and I was interested in asking you about, is that it's not enough to produce renewable energy. You also need to cut out the fossil fuels. When I was looking up the data earlier, I wasn't totally surprised by it, but I noticed that in terms of the absolute amounts of renewable energy produced, China and the United States, just because they're such huge countries in their own right, are actually the biggest producers of renewable energy. And UK isn't doing badly on this metric either. It's down in fourth place. But that's not as such good news as it perhaps sounds, because unless you're aggressively cutting your fossil fuel use, producing a lot of renewable energy and expanding renewable supply is not going to cut it when it comes to climate change, right?
No, exactly. So the UK, we're still subsidising the fossil fuel industry through various tax breaks and direct subsidies. And globally, the plan is to keep increasing the amount of fossil fuels we burn. And that just can't go on. We've got to make proper cuts in the amount of fossil fuels we actually burn, the amount we produce. And that plan isn't in place yet at all.
And could you tell us something about the North-South disparity here? I mean, I feel that it's one of those things that in some ways is talked about a lot. I think the climate movement in general is a lot better at talking about global justice issues now than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. But on the other hand, in terms of the public debate, I still think this idea hasn't really cut through yet, because we're not all affected by climate change in the same way. And the disparities in effect, of course, it's all a little bit uncertain still, could be huge compared to, you know, what happens in northern European countries compared to what happens in some of the very poor Pacific Island states that are facing almost extinction. So there's this huge potential disparity in effect. And then it feeds into this other disparity too, that of course, historically, the global north is much more to blame for the problem of climate emissions just because of the introduction of industrialization in the first place, right?
Yeah, all of that is true. And one thing that's really difficult is putting the numbers on this. And there's this whole interaction with the amount of population there is as well. So people always pointing at, for example, India and saying, look, they've got a really huge population. They need to cut their fossil fuels because look at the overall number. But you go and look at it properly. And Jason Hickel from Goldsmiths did the best study I've seen on this, looking really properly at, for example, you know, according to population, what is your fair share of the fossil fuels that we've used up so far? What is your fair share of CO2 emissions that we've used up so far as a country? And how much have you actually used? And so what's your debt to the world? And that's, I think, a really good way of doing it, because you're actually looking at the overall population and looking back far enough as well, because our debt as the UK, we started this basically. We were the first in the 1800s to start really burning the fossil fuels. And very few analyses have looked that far back to really put the numbers on it. And when you do that, we're the fourth highest over user, as it were, in terms of our fair share of fossil fuels historically in the world. And that means we owe a debt to places like India. India's the highest under user of fossil fuels over the years. So you have to look at things with this huge historical perspective. And of course, the Black Lives Matter campaigns, the campaigns on behalf of people affected by climate change in the global south, are gaining more prominence now. We're seeing more from people who are going to be most affected. But even so, I hear some ridiculous ignorance from people on this, who's to blame and who needs to cut their emissions the most. And if we take that proper historical perspective, we owe the world, and we've got to get on with it faster than anybody else and be leading the way. And that's what I want the country to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that work in the climate movement has been really good. Sometimes people talk about it as green finance, don't they? Like the debt that has accumulated by countries like Britain that now needs to be paid down. That's as significant as our public debt and should actually be treated in the same way. And, you know, it's very difficult to, well, it should be an easy argument to get out there and make, but just our politics on it is just so depressing, because we're cutting our development budget at the moment when we should be raising it significantly to fund renewable energy all over the world, right, to pay down that debt.
Yeah, exactly. We owe the world, and we've got some of the expertise. We've got some of the best ideas in the world that could be being exported, along with, you know, money to fund it. And why we aren't doing that? We should be that country.
Well, I mean, my feeling about it, I always get in a tangle about the difference between the things you need to do and the things which will work as messages. So in my head, I'm thinking, yeah, I completely agree with that about, you know, taking a historical view and taking responsibility and taking that responsibility as seriously as financial responsibility. But then the kind of lay-off part of me chimes in with, we need to kind of reframe it around, you know, for as long as you're kind of counting numbers and counting and having kind of deficit and debt columns, then you're playing into an essentially kind of anti-environmental cost-benefit analysis against, of kind of mankind against nature. And you can never make a business case for nature, because nature is eternal and business is immediate. So as soon as you start applying those kind of MBA structures to the conversation, then nature always loses. The eternal thing always loses. And part of me thinks that actually what really inspires me at the moment, and why I feel quite positive about the movement in 2021, is that it feels incredibly fruitful and generous, you know, the kind of surge in climate movements, especially youth climate movements. The accent is really on global cooperation and, you know, everybody in Stockholm thinking the same as everybody in London, thinking the same as everybody in Bangladesh, but also there's a kind of real sense of possibility. And I think this came out in Biden's speech.
The cry for survival comes from planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now we will be judged, you and I, by how we resolve these cascading crises of our era.
This kind of sense that if we pool all our resources, then we've got a limitless supply. And it's very much kind of the renewables message. This isn't just the kind of second best. We're not going on a diet with renewables. You've got something kind of generous and vast and limitless. And I feel like that's coming across quite strongly at the moment, and it is quite positive.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that's the cool thing about Biden. Not that Biden is cool, but actually, on the contrary, that Biden isn't cool. Biden is just a mainstream Democrat. I was reading this quite good analysis by one of the American pollsters, which was basically showing on every issue throughout his entire career, Biden has always positioned himself on the center of the Democratic Party and broadly, therefore, on like kind of the center of American politics. And the fact that he's actually come out over the last 12 months with really, in American terms, historically very progressive like policies, and that climate change and environmentalism has been central to his campaign, that is really exciting. We don't know whether he'll deliver on it. He might be a terrible failure. We need mass movements. But the fact that he calculates that it's necessary for him to position himself as a leader, a global leader on climate change, that's got to be a huge opportunity, and shows how this in lots of countries is just going to be becoming a doorstep issue. Like the days where, you know, environmentalism was considered something that ordinary people didn't talk about, I think, pretty much over.
I think that's a really good point. I think the kind of let's build back better goes alongside really clearly with the let's build a better future message that's kind of always been there within environmentalism. And I think people are now looking for, you know, essentially a fresh start, some kind of new plan, a new template to build to. And everybody has been thinking about this and thinking about how things like the Green New Deal movement, which you've got to give absolute credit to the left of the Democratic Party there in America for bringing Green New Deal into the mainstream. But the idea that by creating a new kind of world, you're creating good new jobs for people, good things for people to do, a transition from the previous way of doing things, getting rid of business as usual. All those things come together so well in the questions of what we do to recover from this next recession that we're facing because of the pandemic, and in how we rebuild something that's environmental. It's such a positive message. It's a new mission for the world. And if we could all just align behind that, that would be a really good thing, left and right.
Looking forward to this year ahead, I mean, we do talk about UK politics quite a lot on this podcast. We do have a lot of international listeners, so I hope they must just be quite interested in UK politics, or we try to give UK politics an international angle. But Boris Johnson has made a big pitch for global leadership on climate change. Sean, what do we make of his claims, like versus the reality? What's the situation in UK? And obviously the context for this is that next, I think it's November, isn't it? The COP26 will be happening in Glasgow, the annual massive climate conference where the world takes stock and says, we're not meeting our targets on climate change. We've got to do better annually. But it's a really important moment for international politics, but also something to aim for climate activism as well.
Yeah, so Boris Johnson's very, very good at giving a speech or a press conference that doesn't really say very much. And I think that's what we saw. We saw them declaring their new targets. And the new target is much better that's come from the government. But then the 10-point plan that followed was very much just one side of the equation. It was, I mean, I've just talked about innovation and great new green jobs and things like that. There were an awful lot of big, fancy silver bullets in Boris Johnson's statements, and not so much of the hard work, the grassroots jobs, the things fixing people's homes, for example,
that we really, really need. So things like, what was it called? Jet zero, like trying to come up with aviation that's zero carbon, things like nuclear power and hydrogen, things that are, you know, not quite there yet and require innovation, these kind of silver bullets that mean we don't really need to change anything. That's the theme of Boris Johnson's climate action. And it's not going to cut it. There's an awful lot that needs to be done at a grassroots level that's much more about local communities acting or people going into everybody's home and fixing something that isn't right, like the windows and the insulation. So I'm not convinced that we're there yet with the UK. And of course, there was not a word about things like cancelling the roads programme, you know, stopping airport expansion. The side of the equation that's reducing fossil fuel use wasn't in there at all. There were just these sort of future silver bullets that he wants to announce that we're going to get to, this kind of moonshot idea that they keep coming up with. And it doesn't cut it. We've seen that with the pandemic as well.
My anxiety with the Conservatives, and obviously I've never been sympathetic to them, so it's surprising to me that I would get a new anxiety. But I think their current iteration as a party is one in which the entire mechanism of the state is there to serve their needs as a party, right? They don't have a plan for the country. They have a plan for the party. And what that means is that they change their minds all the time. You know, we talk about U-turns as though they're kind of hapless or kind of decisions made on the hoof and then proven to be wrong and then they change their mind and et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that is what's going on. I think they will literally wake up in the morning and do whatever suits the Conservatives that day, whether it's that they're trying to move on to a different conversation, whether they're trying to distract from some other disaster, whether there's a kind of corruption agenda and they want to hand a contract over to one of their associates. It's whatever suits the party that day is what they're going to do. And of course, that's a bad approach for everything in government, not least public health. But it's the worst possible approach for the environment because it means initiatives don't last. Initiatives are quite facile. Initiatives are quite kind of headline grabbing, but not necessarily bottomed out, as you say, Sean. And I don't feel like they're ever going to change. I don't think there is a long range commitment to addressing climate change. I think there's simply a long range commitment to keeping the Conservative Party alive. And that, I think, is much more terrifying than any individual one of their statements or any individual policy they devise.
Yeah, it's politics as an exercise in political communications. To go back to what you were talking about commas earlier, Zoe, I mean, I do get, with apologies to Scotland, like, I do think that the slogan Global Britain could actually be quite a good slogan if it was given some content. You know, it could fit in a whole range of things from climate justice to having a very open, progressive human rights agenda and really championing that and be proud of it. But we can't use that, unfortunately, because it's just so associated with the Tories. And they do have, as you say, this vision of the state as a kind of platform organisation to deliver the whims of Number 10. And it means their type of decision-making is hyper-centralised and not very strategic. And, well, are quite good at wasting public money on cronyist projects and throwing money at bits and pieces of the electorate that they want to vote for them. So the whole picture of centralisation, politics as communications, cronyism, I mean, it doesn't really bode well for the next 4 years in terms of climate goals, does it?
You touched on it there. There's this magpie element to them where if they see anything that anybody else says, they just kind of swoop in and steal it because it's shiny and it's popular. But that can kind of take the wind out of the sails of an opposition which has a strong commitment and a vision for the future. You know, it's like if you think I've got a vision for what will solve climate change and it's this kind of target for addressing housing needs, and then the Conservatives just come in and steal it and then don't do it and just toxify what was originally quite a good idea. I think it kind of fills everybody with this sense of kind of inertia and pointlessness.
Yeah, there's a real danger of cynicism, isn't there? So, Sean, give us some hope.
What you just said there was so correct about how the Conservatives are. They are really just trying to make sure they stay in power. So if they can say something today that'll get the media off their back, they don't care if they're going to follow it up again later, if they're actually going to achieve the thing that they just announced. It doesn't bother them. And that's been so dangerous during the pandemic. It really, really has. But on the environment, yeah, it's incredibly frustrating because they'll start to call something Green Deal for Britain. And you're like, that's the thing for homes that was called Green Deal was so useless. And it's always, you know, £1 billion instead of £30 billion a year. year, which is what this needs to go into. There's no commitment to finishing it off. And I think that is incredibly frustrating. And it does make people turn off politics as well. I mean, the answer to it from my point of view, I do this in City Hall where I'm challenging the Mayor of London as well, is to have your own plan of what you think ought to be happening and keep an eye on the numbers. Keep tracking how well they're doing. Don't let them get away with failure. Keep pushing for the improvements that you need. But then, yeah, you can so easily be characterised as just saying it for party political reasons, even though what you're saying is genuine accountability. So I'm not having a good time with this government because they'll just say anything to get out of your scrutiny. And really what you want is to be able to deal in facts, and they're being devalued by the day.
To go back to the climate summit, it's not the Cornwall one, is it? It's the Glasgow one.
It's Glasgow next November.
Yeah, Glasgow, yeah.
What are the asks? I mean, is everything in place? Everybody knows what they want and they're just thrashing it out? Or is there still space to play in on that?
There's lots of countries that haven't made the deadline for announcing their new targets that I mentioned before that Boris Johnson had announced. And this is the problem we've had as Greens with this for a few years now, is you'll get your national governments announcing their national commitments, and they're called nationally determined contributions. And then you're supposed to come back 5 years later and go, oh, I didn't manage it. There's nothing in between to sort of hold people to account. And then below the national level, what we don't have are locally defined contributions. So you can just announce at a national level, yeah, we're going to cut our emissions by 60%. And then just sit there, and there's no mechanism for making sure that everything that could contribute to that is also contributing. You need the commitments to cascade down through the levels of power. And so you've got local councils, and including City Hall, where I work with the London Assembly, who set their own targets and want to contribute, but there's no statutory backing for that. And the problem with not having statutory targets coming down to you at a lower level is, without statutory targets, there's no reason for the national government to give you funding to achieve them. So they're resisting doing that for precisely the reason that if they made them statutory targets for local areas and for cities, they'd have to follow it up with funding. So it's very, very difficult at the moment. And I think that's the big argument that needs to be had this November, is getting these contributions at a national level transferred onto the ground to make sure that things actually happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And in the annual climate summit, the international law of climate change, if you like, this is actually quite an important meeting, because you mentioned the 5-year review point, and I believe that we're at the 5-year review, aren't we? So countries will be coming forward and either saying, hey, we've been marvellous and we've met all our targets, or saying, oh, sorry, we've been a bit naughty, we haven't met our targets, but we promised to do X, Y, Z over the next 5 years. So it is quite an important meeting.
So the point of the Paris Agreement is each time you come back, you're supposed to increase your targets. There's a ratcheting up process that's agreed. So yes, if we get people coming back and saying we haven't made our previous target, then asking them to ratchet it up again is going to be difficult. So it's a real reckoning for the world. We'll get a balance sheet out of this and hopefully new commitments. But we need to be putting the pressure on to make sure that happens. And the problem with a virtual summit, which it might end up being, is it's hard for the ordinary people, the campaigners, the people who care passionately about this, to have their voices heard in the normal way we would with a big summit like this. We'd all pile up there and be being creative on the streets.
Is your feeling that is it going to be a virtual summit then, or is it going to be an in-person one? I mean, it's in November. It's in a big grey area for whether anything will be possible in terms of where COVID is then.
Nobody really knows at the moment, and that's another of the difficulties. In theory, it's going to be an in-person summit, and there's a lot of value to that, actually, in terms of negotiations. The ways that people sort of meet offline as well to do mini negotiations is really, really important. But in terms of my job and our job, all of our job as citizens, how we influence people if it isn't a physical summit, and if we're not allowed to get into big crowds and do creative things and show our feelings as a collective, I think that's going to be really hard.
Yeah, I mean, obviously safety first and zero COVID, as you and Caroline in Parliament and others have been arguing for and everything. But I have to say, as a campaigner, I'd really love to go up to COP26 and have a post-pandemic demonstration and go to a load of talks and feel like we're making our voices heard. So that does feel very optimal to me.
Obviously, in the absence of being able to pile up to Glasgow, what can and should climate activists be trying to work on between now and November?
I would say get signed up to as many organisations as you possibly can. You know, sign up to the Greens, obviously, Friends of the Earth, you know, Green New Deal UK are a really good organisation working on this, 350.org, obviously Greenpeace and the big climate campaigners globally. People and Planet, if you're younger, you'd get signed up. And those campaigners are all thinking very, very hard about this at the moment. And there will be things we can do. There will definitely be things we can do. But as someone who's used to being on the streets to show my feelings about this kind of thing, I will miss it. But we will be coming up with things that mean we can put pressure on and make sure that people know that we care.
Fantastic. That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we talk about Brexit and the chaos facing importers, exporters, and our fishing industry. What a mess it is. It is a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. You can join at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.
I want to know what you make of the crisis. Yeah, I don't know whether you're for or against Brexit, Luke.
Well, I was totally bowled over by the seafood stuff. As someone who's been following this for like 5 years and studying the talks and everything, I mean, even I was completely shocked, because if you put it in the context of the simple fact that fisheries and seafood was one of the main priorities of the British government in the talks, to now have the entire seafood sector protesting with trucks on the streets of London, complaining that the rules that have been introduced at 1 week's notice, remember, you know, it's incredibly short time frame, basically make the industry, particularly in Scotland, unviable, is just a breathtaking bit of incompetence. It's like mind-blowing. It's hard to get your head around.
It is. It goes back to what you were saying before, I think, that the government currently are in it for themselves. I mean, you could have been forgiven for assuming that the Conservative Party would be working on behalf of business, working on behalf of particularly the industries that back them over Brexit. But to not even pay attention to that particular industry, it is astounding. And I'm, you know, I can't understand how they think they can get away with this now. But in the world that we're in, I don't know if they will try and bluff it out again.
That's another one of my worries, is that it gets to the point where there's such a pile-up of crap, you know, of poorly thought-out decisions, of a complete lack of foresight, of a load of cronyism and corruption. It gets to the point where headlines can't touch them because everybody's expecting something bad to happen. It's like what they say about kind of politicians individually, that you can get away with any kind of infraction so long as it matches who you said you were, you know. So Clinton could get away with having a roving eye, shall we say, because that was who he said he was. But if he'd been financially corrupt, that wouldn't have been who he said he was. You know, people will take an awful lot if it chimes with your self-presentation. And I feel like the Conservatives have presented themselves now as so poor in so many areas that we're just going to get used to them. We're just going to adjust to the new reality in which the government doesn't think ahead and doesn't see anything coming and makes a hugely expensive mess out of everything. So my feeling with Brexit is, like, we can't just kind of sit back and digest more bad headlines, you know, more rotting meat having to be chucked in landfill, more fish that's wasted, more industries that are crippled. If we kind of sit and wait for it to happen, even if there's a part of me that thinks this is exactly what everybody said would happen, so, you know, of course it's going to unfold this way. I feel like there has to be a more creative way to respond, but I don't know yet what it is.
We need another general election, basically. I mean, it's like that thing about if you're going to tell a lie, tell a big enough lie, because that's how you can get away with it. It's like if you're going to mess something up, just mess something up in the most spectacular way and then brazen it out and you won't have to resign. The amount of resigning issues there have been in the last year is huge. There's been no competence at all, and yet they're still there. And our system means that there isn't going to be a general election anytime soon, but we could really do with one right now.
Yeah, I do wonder, like, what the mindset of your, and they are still quite large in number, but they never say anything, middle road Tory MPs, neither Remainer nor hardline Brexiteers, but basically just pro-market, quite neoliberal Tory MPs. I mean, did they really come into politics to destroy Britain's trading relationship with its biggest trading partner and really screw over businesses? I mean, Peter Gagan made a point that has stuck with me when we did a podcast with him, the Open Democracy journalist, and he said the Conservatives are raising more money from business than ever before, in terms of the amount, but it's coming from a really narrow group of individuals and people that tend to have money in property development, hedge funds and private equity. So in terms of who's funding the Tories, it gives a real like tilt towards the speculation, casino capitalism stuff. And that's not the whole of the British economy, ultimately. It's even a minority of the City of London, you know. So you can kind of make sense of their politics in terms of their paymasters to some degree. But in terms of a party that's actually capable of running Britain, it's just, like, gobsmacking, really. Especially when, you know, you take coronavirus, this really terrible public health emergency, but has also had this huge economic effect because it closed down the services sector, and with all the negativity that we're aware of. Now, the thing that kept going fine through 2020 was haulage, was freight, was trade with Europe and the rest of the world. The food kept coming in, goods kept coming in, and it was largely unaffected by coronavirus. So you take the thing that hasn't been affected that much, and then you sort of set out through this policy to mess that up too. So I do think they are in a bit of an impossible mess, an impossible contradiction that's hard to square.
My feeling about when it kind of lands on them, I think it's going to be a bit like the food poverty thing. It's like everybody knew that this was a massive problem and they weren't dealing with it. But it took that moment on Twitter when Roadside Mum posted what she'd been sent for 2 weeks worth of lunches for everybody to just say, OK, enough, no further. And I think that's going to happen with certainly with the haulage and fish and meat and vegetables scandal. We're going to get to the point where, you know, you can't get a leek anywhere or any bacon, and people are going to start kind of posting these very kind of arresting visuals around the mismanagement of it. And I think that will kind of create some noise. And, you know, true to form, I think they will scramble around and they'll find a quick fix, and it won't be consistent with or coherent, but that's not who they are. They're not a consistent or coherent government. I've got a kind of wider anxiety about just kind of slow decline, and just, you know, the way the drunk in a village, there are just more and more people they can't get credit from until they can't get credit from anyone. And I just feel like that's going to be us in our trading relationships. Every time anybody's faced with the choice between buying it from a British company or buying it from any other company in the world, they'll choose any other company in the world. And I think that's what I'm finding really terrifying. Yeah, sorry, that's quite a grim note to sound.
It's really hard, partly because, you know, Project Fear and people saying doom and gloom things about Brexit was given such a bad name, and so you really, really hesitate to do it. But things like that you just said, I mean, the music industry, the amount that's suffering from the inability for people to move around, we're seeing the same with sciences, another area in which we ought to be maintaining our international, long-term, historical reputation in the science. Sorry, I did science at university, so I'm really like, it's like if I was in a band, I'd be giving the example about the music industry. But it's just, what a waste, you know, the idea that, like you said, Zoe, you know, slow decline, the idea that we might just bash and knock down something so built up over such a long time and just put countries off trusting us and investing in us or coming here and working with us as individuals. It's just so sad. It's so sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right, Zoe, that that would be the mindset of the Tories. I mean, the problem is that it's not as easy to solve and set of issues as a free school meals, which they can solve tomorrow if they had the political will to do it. They would need to go back to the European Union and try to amend the treaty that they've just signed. And the EU will go, ha ha ha, we told you so, didn't we? And so it will be quite a humiliating moment for the UK, which means, unfortunately for everyone else, it's going to have to get quite bad for that crisis to happen. But I think it almost certainly will do, you know. All of the information that we have in terms of all of the posts on Twitter and stuff from lorry drivers and wine exporters and all of these people who are affected, you know, it's clearly not a sustainable situation.
No, and the only ultimate way of dealing with this is to go back and change the treaty. The treaty is a mess. Those customs rules that you have to go through for exporting, they're just not fit for purpose if you want to operate in any sensible way. So that's the difficulty. And this is, again, why, you know, we could do with a new government. We could do with a government of unity. And I just wonder at what point the crises will get large enough that we make a move. And you're right, I think, that the moderate Conservative MPs might just turn around at some point and go, actually, enough. But when that will happen, I don't know.
Right, well, watch this space. But thanks so much for coming on and talking to us, Sian.
I actually do feel quite positive about the environment, even if I don't feel that positive about Brexit.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I'll go back to my day job now, which is making a plan for London. Over, I mean, and I complained before about not having the powers that come with statutory responsibilities. London has more devolution than most areas, and so in terms of making a plan for London, I can get on with quite a lot. So that cheers me up on my in my day job.
Great. Well, best of luck as well in the upcoming election too.
Thank you. It's a bit depressing, do you not think? Our conversation just went down a rabbit hole of, oh, actually, wait, we're all doomed, basically.
Oh, I didn't think that that was depressing. I thought that actually, I thought that we were all saying that it's not sustainable and change will come. Something will break in this approach.
I think there's a way to make it more positive, right? Which is that I just want to go back to Biden's inauguration speech. What he did was he didn't talk very much at all about what had caused the divisions in the nation. He kind of threw everybody's gaze towards climate change. That's what was so hopeful about it. Not that climate change is in itself a kind of cause for huge hope, but he just moved the focus to something real that you could do now and you could work together on. And then all the stuff that nobody's been able to work together on for the past 4 years, it wasn't solved and it didn't evaporate. It just receded immediately. And I feel like that with Brexit in a way. I feel like if we just move the focus onto the real things that we can change that aren't really to do with Europe or only insofar as we need, everybody needs to be working in concert, then, you know, we can just really retake the mood.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of did say halfway through about the idea that building a better world is in a lot of people's minds. People are thinking ahead like that. And so to get some politicians together who've got a plan, who want to work together and do something good, would be amazing. But I think the idea that we have another general election where it's just Labour or the Tories and it's all very, very sort of divisive, I think, you know, one thing we could do is create some sort of united opposition, some kind of government of unity to take us to this next stage.
I think there's another side on the Tories too, which is in our favour, which is basically if they had never claimed to be on the side of the working class, which they basically did in 2019, we said we're on the side of the poor, they wouldn't be as vulnerable to the criticism over free school meals and their general welfare policy on universal credit and other things. And I think climate change is similar too, you know. They are saying, I don't think they'll deliver, but they are saying we need a climate revolution. I mean, they're always copying opposition slogans, aren't they? Build Back Better started as a progressive slogan and then the Tories took it up. I think they've even said Green Industrial Revolution, which was a Labour line from like the 2019 manifesto. So they're shameless. But it does mean that the country is talking about the issues that we want the country to talk about. And that's a good thing. That must bode well for the future.
I think it's in people's minds that the ideas we've been talking about for a long time, the idea that, yeah, we need to build back better, we need a Green New Deal, we need to transform the economy, all of those things are kind of what people are expecting to happen, but they're not going to happen under this government. And the realisation that actually we're going to have to change the personnel is like has happened in America, I think is really going to dawn on people quite soon.
All right, fantastic.